You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Wednesday, October 7th, 2020. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, former economics columnist for Harper's and New York Times, author and journalist Jeff Madrick on Invisible Americans, the tragic cost of child poverty. Also on the program today, it's Miller time. At least 34 people connected to Donald Trump are COVID positive. Stephen Miller, just the latest, as the West Wing is in disarray. I'm not sure if that's a new thing or just a continuing of an old show. Department of Justice Inspector General draft report leaks shows Jeff Sessions and Rod Rosenstein are just as despicable as you could imagine. Trump announces no more COVID economic stimulus, and then sort of changes his mind, and then sort of changes his mind again. Dr. Fauci warns us that we could see 400,000 coronavirus deaths without a course change quickly. And it's debate night. Kamala Harris, Mike Pence, and a lot of plastic barriers. Can you blame her? St. Louis gun couple, stars of the Republican National Convention, indicted on multiple counts by a grand jury. And in functioning government news, the European Parliament backs a 60% emission cut by 2030. The first federal election with ranked choice will go forward in Maine despite Republican attempts to stop it. And the White House blocking FDA vaccine guidelines, but people who care about people's health are seeking a workaround. All this and more on today's program. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the show. Thanks for joining us today. We have a debate tonight, 9 p.m. It's going to be on all the networks. We're also going to stream it with commentary on majority.fm and our various outlets. So you can check that out. It should be interesting. There will be, despite the fact that Mike Pence did not want one initially, a plexiglass barrier between the candidates. Because apparently the Trump campaign, they don't believe in testing before you go to a debate. And I have to say, I mean, they don't seem too interested in finding out what happened on that day in terms of Donald Trump's test. I mean, presumably the president's tested every day. And the White House either doesn't seem terribly interested in releasing that information, or they don't seem terribly interested in it at all. Who knows? So, I mean, frankly, if I'm Kamala Harris, I'm wearing a gas mask before I get anywhere close to anybody around the White House. But maybe she's got a little bit more courage, frankly, than I do. I don't know if I'm going to get to this today. I may get to it tomorrow, but I just want to highlight for you, because I don't want this to get lost in the news. This IG report, the Inspector General report from the Department of Justice, it's leaked. It's just a draft. By the time it gets public, who knows how whitewashed it'll be. But the behavior of Jeff Sessions and Rod Rosenstein in regards to the what they call family separation, which I think still can only be described as kidnapping of immigrant children at the border is just, it is shocking. They are chastising U.S. attorneys at the border for not prosecuting families, for not separating families with babies. Babies who are literally breastfeeding. They want them separated and then just shipped off somewhere. It would be nice in this country if we had any type of tradition, and it rarely happens. We had one guy from the DHS who was head of the, or I should say HHS, specifically the subdivision that handled safe vaccines, resigned from the government today. But it would be nice if we had in this culture a more substantial tradition of resigning out of disgust, because I think those five or six U.S. attorneys at the border, that would have been a good thing for them to do. I don't know how you stay in your job, and if your job is to basically kidnap immigrant babies. That to me is just disgusting. We will talk about that later in the program, either today or we'll get to it tomorrow. In the meantime, Donald Trump did one of the crazy, now I know this is hard to believe. And of course, he's done a lot more crazy things than this. But in terms of politics, what Donald Trump did last night was really a stunning display. The only thing it leads me to believe is that he got off the phone with Mitch McConnell and did not understand. I mean, this is a guy who, whenever he gets briefings about politics, you get the sense that he doesn't get that there's a difference between the subtext and the text. This is the reason why you're doing it, and then this is the reason why you're going to say you're going to do it. He doesn't get that. He apparently got it as to why he was, when he was lying about COVID, but these things maybe are just too complicated. The story goes like this. It's been reported that Mitch McConnell got on the phone with Donald Trump and told him, look, there's no point in pursuing any more COVID economic relief. Let's just focus on the courts. This is unsurprising because Mitch McConnell probably perceives a pretty good chance that Donald Trump is going to lose. And what Mitch McConnell cares about is cementing his legacy as the guy who changed the federal courts in such a way that it will ripple through the generations. And it will. In 5 years, in 10 years, in 15 years, we'll still be talking about this term of Donald Trump in regards to federal judges and the Supreme Court. There may be other things too. And I'm presuming that Donald Trump is not the president in the next term. And so that's all Mitch McConnell cares about. He's going to go into the history books as the guy who fundamentally altered the federal judiciary for decades to come. So he must have said this to Donald Trump, and Donald Trump, let's put up the tweets. This is where it starts. Donald Trump says, effectively, Nancy Pelosi is asking for $2.4 trillion to bail out poorly run high crime Democrat states. Now, the fact of the matter is that red states are devastated by this as well. They rely on sales taxes. Many of these red states do. And sales taxes have really taken the biggest brunt of the hit in terms of revenue drops in the states. Nevertheless, money that is no way related to COVID-19, that's absurd. We made a very generous offer of $1.6 trillion, and as usual, she is not negotiating in good faith. I am rejecting their request and looking to the future of our country. I have instructed my representatives to stop negotiating until after the election, when immediately after I win, we will pass a major stimulus bill that focuses on hardworking Americans and small businesses. I have asked Mitch McConnell not to delay, but to instead focus full time on approving my outstanding nominee to the United States Supreme Court, Amy Coney Barrett. Our economy is doing very well. The stock market is at record levels, jobs and unemployment also coming back in record numbers. In fact, actually, the job numbers are starting to go the opposite direction. Stock market got a little bit concerned about the failure of relief. Mitch McConnell probably looked at those tweets and said, well, he sort of got what I was telling him to do. But to announce as the president of the United States I am calling off all negotiations to get relief to the American public is basically handing the Democrats a huge, huge gift, which is it's quite clear they don't care about providing relief. I mean, look, the Democrats passed the HEROES Act. What was it, 4 months ago? More at this point? Republicans passed nothing. They couldn't even meet in conference to negotiate it up. They passed nothing. Democrats passed another one, a $2.2 trillion bill, I don't know, a couple of weeks ago. Republicans passed nothing. You could argue if you're Donald Trump, like, oh, we're trying to negotiate, but Nancy Pelosi won't move, blah, blah, blah. But if you end it yourself and you announce that you're ending it, it's on you. And so somebody, and he must be sitting alone in his, I don't know, in the White House. And then somebody was like, hey, what's going on? Get on the phone. Tell him to tweet something else. And so then we get this. Crazy Nancy Pelosi and the radical left Democrats were just playing games. I don't know why that's in quotes. With the, I don't know. Maybe that means something different. What is the, what is quotes? Why would you put that in quotes, Matt?
I think it's somebody. Yeah, I have no idea, actually.
It wasn't literally games. They weren't playing actual games. They weren't. Nancy Pelosi wasn't playing like, you know, Yahtzee. And then with the desperately needed workers' stimulus payments. They just wanted to take care of Democrat-failed high-crime cities and states. His capitalization stuff is a little bit weird. They were never into it to help the workers, and they never will be. So now he's a little bit concerned. And then he goes, the House and Senate should immediately approve $25 billion for airline payroll support and $135 billion for Paycheck Protection Program for small business. There's still money in the Paycheck Protection Program, or if there isn't, it's simply because it sat in there and it expired. That's over. Those people have lost their jobs. Both these will be fully paid for with unused funds from the CARES Act. Well, it's the same. Have this money. I will sign now. Have this money. I will sign now. I don't know. If I am sent, wow. This is at 10:18, and I think things are getting a little hazy for him. If I am sent, oh, I see what he's saying. If I am sent a standalone bill for stimulus checks, $1,200, they will go out to our great people immediately. I'm ready to sign right now. Are you listening, Nancy? Where's the Senate bill? There's no Senate bill about $1,200 checks. So he realizes that he had a huge, huge political fail. And Democrats all around the country now, I would imagine, are going to be running on that first tweet, in addition to healthcare. In the meantime, the American public is suffering. And our guest coming up in a moment, Jeff Madrick, is going to tell us that the people who are suffering the most are the children of this country. And they have been for a long time. And he's got some ideas on how to fix that. They won't happen under the Trump administration. I don't know if they would happen under a Biden administration, but we can try. Before we get to Jeff Madrick, a couple words from our sponsors. As you know, I am a big proponent of dental hygiene. And as you get older, you start to realize you may have made mistakes in the past in terms of your dental hygiene. Well, I have corrected all mine with Quip. And I haven't just corrected it with me in my home. Both my children now have Quips. My older daughter has the full-size Quip. My son has the small Quip. I swear to God to you. He said to me last night, it was two nights ago. I think last night, actually, he was yelling at me. Two nights ago. He said, you know why I like to brush teeth now? And I said, why is that? Now, he's been brushing with Quip, I don't know, for about 6, 7, 8 months. I don't know. And I no longer have to worry about a count your ABCs thing. And then he races through it because it has a pulsing thing that tells you, it counts out 2 minutes, tells you to switch the four quadrants of your mouth. They have watermelon flavored toothpaste for the kids. I mean, I use it sometimes too, but don't tell him I do that. And he loves it. brushes every morning. I mean, I sometimes I have to remind him, but I don't have to badger him. And that's the point. You can get the, it doesn't matter what kind of toothbrush you have. At the end of the day, you got to use it. And Quip makes their electric toothbrush easy to use. It is not a big bulky thing. It's not going to fall off your small pedestal sink. It's almost the size of a regular toothbrush. It's very stylish, frankly. And what they do, they send you a Quip brush head, toothpaste, floss, dental floss. They deliver it on a dentist recommended schedule every 3 months. You got to change out that toothbrush head for just $5 each. Shipping is free. You can join 3 million happy customers using Quip starting at $25. Folks, I've given these as presents. They're awesome. They're easy to take with you too when you're traveling. They're not a big bulky thing that you can't fit in your Dob kit. Do we still call it a Dob kit? If you go to getquip.com/majority right now, you get your first refill free. That's your first refill free at getquip.com/majority. Spelled get, G-E-T, quip, Quip.com/majority. Quip, the good habits company. Also, everybody has watched all their playlists. You're tired of the same shows you've been watching over and over again. Well, ExpressVPN lets you change your location so you can control where you want sites to think you're located. Now, this gives you added privacy as you're streaming, you know, as you're looking around the web. What it also does is it allows you to view from almost 100 different countries to watch all sorts of different streaming platforms, right? So you, what you do is you open the app, you select a location, you tap one button to connect. It's super easy. I got it on my phone. I got it on my iPad. I get on my computer, but mostly it's an iPad and phone thing for me. You tap one button to connect. You refresh the page to access thousands of new shows and movies. You choose from almost 100 different countries. You can watch Studio Ghibli films on UK Netflix, anime on Japanese Netflix. I've turned some people on to some, a buddy of mine. He's got a kid who loves Japanese anime for the life of me. I don't understand any of it, but ExpressVPN has now opened up that door for them. I'm trying to introduce Myla to Doctor Who, the one you can only get in the UK. They also have Star Trek Discovery, I think it is, on UK Netflix. Here, you can't get it. It's paywalled. But all you got to do is fire up your ExpressVPN. You can also stream in HD. No problem whatsoever. No buffering, no lag. Not only does it let you change your location, like I say, it encrypts your data and lets you surf the web safely and anonymously. Check it out. It opens it up. It doesn't matter. Hulu, BBC, iPlayer, YouTube, all change your location and check out a whole mess of new shows that are just simply not available in this country for whatever reason. I'm not sure I understand the dynamics of that, but that's the fact. Go to expressvpn.com/majority. Get an extra 3 months of ExpressVPN for free. ExpressVPN.com/majority. Check that out. And lastly, as you know, flu season right around the corner. We are dealing with a whole mess of mess, as it were. You got to take care of yourself, proper vitamins, stay hydrated. That's why Liquid IV created Hydration Multiplier Plus immune support to maintain and strengthen your immune system. Now, look, you know, every day, one of these cups is full of their matcha energy drink, Liquid IV. And now what I'm doing every morning before I even head into work, I'm doing immune support. I'm also doing other stuff too. Like I'm eating Brazil nuts, a couple of Brazil nuts a day. Somebody told me that was a good thing to do, but the immune support is something that I can trust. And I know for a fact, it's going to help me. Has vitamin C, has vitamin D, has zinc, has Wellmune, all in a convenient single serving packet. Vitamin C and D and zinc, you probably know, are great for your immune system support. And Wellmune, which is a naturally sourced beta glucan, it's proven to help strengthen your immune system. Each packet is bursting with fresh, natural tangerine flavor. It tastes really good. It's like orange juice, except for it's not just, sort of pasteurized. It actually has enhanced vitamins build your immune system. And in response to COVID-19, products are being donated to hospitals, first responders, food banks, veterans, and active military. Liquid IV, on top of that, donates a serving of Liquid IV to someone in need. Check out their new Hydration Multiplier Plus immune support system. It's available at Walmart, or you can get 25% off when you go to liquidiv.com. Use the code MajorityRep. Majority Rep at checkout. That's 25% off anything you order when you use the promo code Majority Rep at liquidiv.com. Get better hydration today at liquidiv.com. Promo code Majority Report. All right, quick break, and then we're going to come back with Jeff Madrick. We are back. Joining us now on the program, I want to welcome back to the show, former economics columnist for Harper's and the New York Times, regular contributor to the New York Review of Books and The Nation. He's a visiting professor of humanities at the Cooper Union and the director of the Bernard L. Schwartz Rediscovering Government Initiative, fellow at the Century Foundation, and found time to author multiple books. Jeff Madrick, his latest, The Invisible Americans, Tragic Cost of Child Poverty. Jeff, welcome to the program. Oh, we got a sound issue. Jeff, are you there?
Can you hear me now?
Yes, we can. Sorry, okay. you were muted. Welcome back to the program. I think it's been a couple of years since...
Yeah, I'm sure, but who can count?
These
an eventful days, couple of years.
Exactly. Pretty appropriate timing for this. I mean, obviously, I guess maybe part of the problem is that the appropriateness of the timing for this has been sort of ongoing for years and years, and that is in many respects the problem. Let's start with this. It's a broad question, but it's an important one. What is it that we don't understand, do you think, as a body politic, as a society, about child poverty?
Well, the reason I did this book is I was shocked when I started to look at the data. We have the highest child poverty rate among major rich nations, basically the highest child poverty rate among any rich nation, with one or two minor exceptions, and usually higher by far than any rich nation. The thing is, I found in reporting and discussing this issue with people, they don't fully believe poor children. Many don't even believe there are poor children in America. Now, a poor child lives in a family of three, let's say, that earns $21,000 a year, a family of four, 25 or 26. Those are the official poverty numbers, and they vastly understate poverty. What I want to say mostly about children in poverty is they suffer. They suffer for lack of opportunity. They suffer from the shame of being poor. They know they're poor. But they suffer mostly, maybe I shouldn't even say mostly, from being cognitively deprived. They have less education. They have lower IQs. I have to say, in the last 20 to 30 years, academic researchers have done extraordinary work trying to isolate the effects of poverty on these kids. Poverty causes reduced IQ. Poverty causes reduced educational attainment. And it continues on to adulthood. They work fewer hours. They make less money. That is to say, young adults who grew up in poverty. So what I want, when you ask that question, and I want to emphasize, and I hope I've been doing it adequately, that these kids suffer. They are often in ill health. They know they are outsiders in a society, and we ask them to be responsible for themselves because we don't provide adequate aid to their parents.
And give us, a sense, is there a, and what are we talking about in terms of numbers?
Well, we're talking 10 to 20 million kids are poor. The official, one of the great problems in America, and it reflects our attitudes towards the poor, which are pretty much that the poor are responsible for their own poverty. That's been historically true now for a couple hundred years, the general attitudes. The number, the measure of poverty in America is totally inadequate. At least 10 million are poor. Many of us, if we measured it correctly, it would be 20 million and even 30 million kids poor. That is the point at which deprivation sets in and affects future prospects.
Okay, so when we say what does it mean to be poor? What is the definition? I mean, I understand the numbers, what we're talking about in terms of numbers, but in terms of practice, are we talking about you're skipping meals? You are there's not proper daycare, I guess. Proper daycare, I guess. You know, any daycare.
Yeah. So let me go over that. I have a chapter in the book, Invisible Americans, on this. The most telling problem for poor kids is that they are hungry. They may not be starving in a traditional way, but some of them are. They get poor nutrition, and they go hungry day after day. If they don't have access to federal lunches in school and federal breakfasts, they are in trouble nutritionally. When the pandemic hit, this was especially dangerous for them because they didn't have school lunches. So first, they're hungry. Secondly, they're often sick and don't get adequate attention. That's pretty serious. They can be born with prenatal problems, postnatal problems. So they're often less healthy. They have inferior educations. They tend to go to schools that are underfunded in the states they're in compared to other schools. And those schools usually have high proportions of poor kids. So they don't get to learn from other better off kids. They don't necessarily have enough clothes. Their parents don't necessarily have heat and electricity. There are all kinds of deprivations, and the deprivation levels are actually higher. The deprivation rates, when you measure the kinds of things I just discussed, than the poverty rate itself. They don't have much of a chance. And I want to emphasize the point that they are ashamed. They know, as I said at the outset, they are poor. And when people make fun of their parents for buying them sneakers or iPhones, middle-class people just don't understand. These kids are not showing off. They just want to belong, and they don't want to be ashamed. There is an attitude towards poor people in this country, and this is world globally, actually, that disrespects the poor. It shows little respect for the poor. And my book, if anything, is about that, because I want to give unconditional cash allowances to parents of poor kids.
Yeah, I want to get to that that solution, but I want to talk about a couple of those other things that you touched on here. We know, and I've seen different measures of this, but we know that children living in poverty, when they enter into pre-K or K, more often. I mean, now we have universal pre-K in New York City, for instance, but that is not the typical around the country. We know that when they enter kindergarten, they have a vocabulary deficit, the number of words that they have been exposed to is dramatically less. I've seen, you know, various measures in the tens of thousands that in terms of the range. But we know this basically because they have been given less real world experiences because it costs money to have these experiences. They have less attention from adults because their parents, may be struggling to get by and maybe going out and trying to find work. Maybe they are just sat in front of the TV because there isn't, any money for daycare. So they start off behind the ball, and that just continues through because so much is they're not getting supplemented in any way.
That's I do discuss the vocabulary issue in my book. That's one of many. It's one of the more dramatic illustrations of the issue, but there are even more dramatic illustrations. neurologists have pretty much confirmed that poor kids, deprived zero to three, certainly zero to six, literally have brain damage. Their brains do not develop as rapidly as their peers. The good news is if they are treated better later on, their gray matter can begin to be restored, but often they're simply not. So that's one example. There are a couple of pathways that academics like to talk about. One is poor parents just don't have enough money to buy the goods, the food, certainly the educational materials for these kids. The second issue is important, though. Those poor parents, single parents or dual parents, live under stress, and they communicate that to the children. That's a big cause of the neural damage, the gray matter damage I've been discussing. So there are two pathways that this occurs, and they're very well documented. This is not some fanciful bleeding heart idea.
Yeah, it escapes me now, and I think it must have been years ago that we interviewed someone who had done this research on stress, and it's incredibly disturbing. You know, I think that sort of like intuitively you think like, oh, well, if you're under stress as a kid, what you're learning is to build, a tolerance for stress. And it's actually the opposite. It makes you more, it debilitates your ability to deal with stress. And that's sort of like contrary to sort of the typical, I don't know if it's the Puritan ethic or whatnot, you know, this whole notion of like, you know, how do you make steel? You melt it and it comes back stronger. It's the opposite when it comes to human beings, apparently. Yeah. All you're doing is diminishing their capacity.
There's a strong feeling in America that if you just work hard, even if you're poor, you'll get ahead. Some of that was a consequence of the post-depression years. The poverty was the characteristic for almost everybody in the Depression. Then the economy grew, partly because of war spending, but for a variety of reasons in the 50s and 60s, and the great middle class developed. People intuitively now feel, well, we just worked hard and we could get there. Then along came publications in the early 60s that showed, hey, we did not conquer poverty. It was still 25% of the population. Michael Carrington's book was the most noteworthy, the other American. In fact, a tidbit, he actually understated the number of poor because he didn't think people would actually believe it when he wrote it in his book. Interesting phenomenon. We have a strong bias against thinking that the poor are underprivileged. We tend to think, I think, some ugly things, that they don't work hard enough, that their parents pass on cultures that are anti-educational, but it simply doesn't, the facts just don't bear this out. They are deprived. The culture of poverty is one of the great myths of our time.
One other thing I wanted to note before we sort of move on is the sort of the history and how we've addressed this and failed to address it is that notion of healthcare. One of the things I think that COVID has also laid bare in some respects. I mean, certainly the issue of children getting meals at schools has been really clear, you know, with the schools shut down. I mean, I think I was aware of how many, I don't think I was aware of just how many kids rely on the New York City schools, for instance, for lunch. We have over 100,000. I think it could be around 140,000 homeless children who look to lunch at school, but the numbers of students who rely on school for a school lunch is huge. And New York, to its credit, also made school lunch free for everybody. So that stigma that you were talking about, and I want to get back to that as well, was reduced. But one of the things that also became clear with COVID is that we had an assault on public hospitals in this state. And we have a lot of data that shows that your chances of dying were directly related to where you lived and your wealth because there was just simply not the hospital facilities there. And COVID reveals it in the face of, like, you know, what your chances are of dying in a pandemic. But underlying that means that there's a whole deficit of health services that will be there for young kids, which obviously, again, will have an impact through their lives.
Well, let me say this. The expansion, Medicaid and the expansion of Medicaid, as well as the CHIP program, which is an insurance program sponsored by Senator Kennedy, with whom I wrote a book, so I feel obliged to mention his name, and the famed and rather right-wing Republican, sorry about that. Well, CHIP, in any case, has provided insurance for a lot of children. A lot of children are covered by this, and it showed improvement in their health. But you raise a significant issue. Number one, even if you're covered by insurance, parents can't always get to the doctor. Doctors, and I use doctors generically meaning all health services, the health services are not always available, as you mentioned. So we have some serious, we have a serious healthcare problem. In fact, it's our, in my view, our health services industry is our biggest problem. We spend more, as you well know, you've probably covered this 50 or 100 times, but we spend more than any other nation per person. And for the most part, we have, with a few exceptional areas, have poorer outcomes. So I think the COVID situation has shown this up to be what it is. But we should, I do want to note that we have made progress covering children with health insurance.
All right. So let's talk about the cost of child poverty. Obviously, there's, you know, if we're not talking just in terms of humanity, there's some people who want to know, is it cost effective for us to deal with child poverty? There's hidden cost associated with child poverty that, you know, beyond the human suffering, although personally, I sort of feel like that's where the conversation probably should end. But for others, they want to see, what's the cost effectiveness? I mean, we have hidden costs associated with poverty to society that that are not necessarily, I think, obvious to people.
Well, Sam, that's, I think, what bothers me the most. A nation that worries about its productivity, that is to say, its source of economic growth, allows, from my point of view, 20 to 30% of its kids to founder cognitively disadvantaged. And the data show they work less when they get older. They don't work as well. They make fewer wages. Some economists and sociologists have put an estimate on how much we lose due to child poverty alone, due to lower productivity, due to poor health, meaning more social services, due to incarceration and the cost of incarceration, due to the need for more anti-poverty programs. It amounts roughly to $1 trillion a year, 5%. That's a pretty widely accepted number now. It was accepted by a broad range of analysts from right to left who did a report for the National Academy of Sciences. So I think that states it most clearly. If we got child poverty down, we could have, don't call it a trillion, call it just half a trillion, 2.5% of the economy. 2.5% of the economy is the amount the economy might grow in a year. And that just keeps building. It's pretty serious.
And that's, you know, for folks, if just simply the sheer the desire to minimize misery isn't enough. Let's talk about the.
But as you hint, it should be enough.
right, of course. But it's also nice to know that this is a smart investment, too, for people who are concerned about things like productivity. What are the things that we've done in the past to attempt to address? I mean, you mentioned already SCHIP. That was Kennedy, as you said, and I think it was Orrin Hatch was the Republican co-sponsored that bill. And we also had the expansion of Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act. That, of course, is in jeopardy now because of the lawsuit that the Trump administration is pursuing with the Supreme Court. And we will know more about that.
And they also want to attach work requirements to the parents who
indeed, which, of course, makes it difficult because a lot of times people aren't working because they can't find a job.
There are no jobs.
Exactly. And so aside from those things that have materially impacted child poverty, or at least the health of children, what are the other things that we have done in an attempt to address it to the extent that we have? How effective have they been?
Since the 1990s or even the 1980s, our social policy has been jobs oriented. Earned income tax credit. You get benefits if you work. The more you make, the better the benefits for up to a point. That has helped reduce child poverty, the earned income tax credit. It's been made more generous a few times. The child tax credit, adopted, I think it was 1996, but my memory, as you noted with Orrin Hatch, is starting to get dim.
We're all there right now.
Child tax credit now is $2,000. This is very important. $2,000 a year. And it only reaches, it does not reach a third of kids fully because their parents don't make enough money. In my view, the beginning of this work-dependent social welfare was in some sense the end of a decent America. We used to give people cash when they needed it. Now, not all those welfare programs worked very well, but they could have been tuned differently than to become workfare programs. So we have a $2,000 child tax credit. That's been beneficial, but it does. Now, there is a bill that the House passed. You probably know about this. Of course, you know about the CARE and HEROES Act. And in the Senate, there's an American Family Act sponsored by Sherrod Brown and other senators. There we go. Which would expand the child tax credit from $2,000 to $3,000 and to $3,600 for kids under six. And it would go to everybody. In other words, everyone would qualify and be sent money, even if their parents made no money. In other words, before you only got paid as a tax credit against earnings. That's a couple of examples. I think more is needed. I hope we'll get a chance to talk about that.
Well, yes, we will in just a moment. But I just walk through this for us. For people don't know what the earned income tax credit is, and even what a tax credit is as opposed to a deduction. Because I think, you know, people hear these things and they don't know what it is. I mean, clearly the way that we have designed these programs is the implication is, you don't want to work. We're going to try and convince you to work by making it a little bit more lucrative than it would be otherwise, which, I mean, obviously has, if I can find a job and I get the job and it makes it a little more lucrative, that helps. And as you said, it's had some impact. But one of the big problems is I can't find a job. And so it's contingent upon something I can't do, and I get no benefits for that. But just explain to a totally a layperson about a tax credit, and then we'll talk about what your proposal is.
So you get if you make $500 a year, let's say if you make $25,000 a year, you have to pay federal income tax on that money. The earned income tax credit allows you to pay less tax on that money, depending on how much you are earning. So if you're way down at the bottom, it supplements the income you're earning because it's reducing your tax bill. It's an effective remedy, but I don't think it's a great remedy for two reasons. One is you may not be able to get a job, but two, more important, you won't get a good paying job. The benefit is bigger if you make more money, the absolute dollars you will save because you would have paid more tax, and the way it's structured, you get more of a credit. The same is true for a child tax credit if you have children. It works the same way. It's dependent on your income. Here's the thing. People began to like this in the 80s when they got disenchanted with welfare. Partly the welfare system wasn't working, but it wasn't working as badly as the anti-welfare people said. And Bill Clinton decided it's the end of the era of big government. One thing we're going to do is reform our welfare system and make it based on work. That was an example. But the earned income tax credit, he also expanded in those years, which was valuable. I don't think it's perfect, though. The social welfare money in America used to go in greater percentage to those who made below the poverty line. Now that's been reduced. There, Hillary Hahn's and other scholars show that quite clearly. Robert Moffat, it's very clear. The reason is we depend on these earned income tax credits rather than depending on actual welfare programs.
Right. And a lot of people, me amongst them, have been very critical of that welfare reform during the Clinton years, because as soon as jobs, the jobs available contracted, many people, the number of extreme poor increased as a result of people living in extreme, what they call extreme poverty, increased as a result of those, you know, so-called reforms that Newt Gingrich was all excited about.
Basically, I only have two welfare programs, the food stamps and TANF, which is very limited and doesn't reach very poor people.
So let's talk about your plan. It's very straightforward. And we should also say, in this era of COVID, there is data coming out of COVID, the first CARES Act that went out, that in many respects sort of like, you know, gives you all the evidence you need that your prescription is the right one. Talk about this.
Well, my prescription comes from a couple of places in my head and heart, forgive me. One is we can't keep treating poor people like they, poor parents like they can't take care of their kids. If the big reason we don't want to give cash is that we think they're going to waste the money on themselves. The evidence is that they don't. It's not only evidence in the U.S. Almost all rich democracies give a cash allowance of some kind or other. Canada, we do, in my think tank, which is part of the supported by Bernard L. Schwartz, we presented the Canadian proposal and talked about how much it would help America if we adopted the Canadian cash proposal. So my attitude is simple. Poor kids need a lot of things, but mostly they need money. And this is not just wishful thinking. One of the things discovered by academics over the last 20 years is the value of money itself. There have been constant, I talk about this, I think I have a chapter in the book that talks about how money matters. The one colorful example is an Indian tribe that developed a very successful casino, and they gave $5,000 to each family that had a child.
This is a Duke study from a Cherokee tribe in North Carolina. Is that right?
Exactly. Okay. Exactly. And they discovered their educational attainment increased, the crime rate decreased. That is compared to their peers in similar tribes and in similar economic circumstances. But that was one example of how cash can matter. So my view is, let's give them cash, $3,000 or $4,000 per child a year, maybe $5,000. Some nations go higher than that. And let the parents figure out how to use that cash best. Buying them a warm coat, having electricity in the wintertime, and buying them books, computers possibly, at least an internet service. And let's treat parents in a respectful way. And I think they'll act in a respectful way if we do that.
Well, we know from the COVID payments that were sent out at the beginning of the crisis, back when, there was at least some attempt to provide relief for Americans. We know that the cash payments ended up reducing the poverty rate. I mean, in a way that, I mean, it sounds quite obvious, but all the data was there. And the other thing is, we also know sort of ideologically, we keep hearing that, you know, you want to localize, you want to give school boards the right to expend their own cash. Well, this is that principle, but on a very meaningful level. And that is, let parents trust parents of children to figure it out. Of course, on the margins of every single endeavor that humans undertake, I think there's, you know, people who don't do the right thing, or they waste it, or whatever it is. But the bulk is important. Now, what you're proposing is also universal, right? I mean, so
universal and taxable. So that if you make higher incomes, it'll be taxed away. The universality is a little bit like Social Security is universal. You want to have everybody, you want to have broad public support for this kind of thing. And but let me also say that giving them cash, you've raised a good point, Sam, giving them cash got poverty down. But now we know getting poverty down gives these kids a chance in school to get good jobs, to be healthy, to be emotionally stable, on and on, and not to have brain damage.
Let me just lastly just add this thing about the universality. You know, people are always talking about means testing, whatnot. We have a way of means testing that is very efficient. This also applies to Social Security for that matter, which is you give everyone a universal amount and you claw it back on the back end with taxes, because we already have an apparatus to determine, you know, taxes. We already have a tax rate. We don't need to create another bureaucracy to see and to force people to jump through hoops to get it in the first place. We could just do it on the back end through taxes. It's the most efficient way. And it also retains support for this program, so people aren't thinking that other people are getting benefits that they're not getting.
Of course, I'd love to raise the progressive tax rate as well. So
you and I both, we can do that as well after we get after we do the heavy lifting of getting those payments out. Jeff Madrick, the book is Invisible Americans: Tragic Cost of Child Poverty. We'll put a link to that book at majority.fm.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate
it. And remember, Sam, it's not the kids' fault that they're poor.
Indeed.
So let's not blame them.
Indeed. Thank you, Jeff. Really appreciate it. I'm reminded of the story that Paul Ryan told. It was, and I raised this many times on the show, and I can't remember exactly where he was, but it was a story that he heard from, I think it was a Wisconsin official. And the story, incidentally, was fake. Not only did Paul Ryan sort of embellish it, and it didn't happen to him, but the story in the first place was fake. And it was something to the effect of, like, they were justifying cutting school lunches. And the story that he told was that he met a kid and he said to the kid, oh, we have the clip. It's at CPAC 2014. Let's play this clip. People need to remember what we're experiencing with Donald Trump is simply an extension of what we had with the Republican Party for decades. When Donald Trump goes out there and he's going to make the case that all this mail-in ballot stuff is corrupt, and he's going to try and invalidate the election results in this state or that state because of mail-in ballots, people should remember that when he started talking about 3 million immigrants being bussed up from Massachusetts to go vote in New Hampshire or whatever it was, Paul Ryan was one of the people who was saying these late results coming in from California, very suspicious, very suspicious. It's not only Donald Trump, folks. It's the Republican Party. Here's a clip of Paul Ryan back at CPAC in 2014, I guess it was. CPAC is where it's sort of like a Comic-Con for conservatives, and they're all it has gotten more and more, frankly, insane since even 2014. It's always been a little bit nuts, but it's gotten even more crazy. Play this clip.
Is making a big mistake here. What they're offering people is a full stomach and an empty soul. The American people want more than that. You know, this reminds me of a story I heard from Eloise Anderson. She serves in the cabinet of my buddy, Governor Scott Walker. She once met a young boy from a very poor family. And every day at school, he would get a free lunch from a government program. He told Eloise he didn't want a free lunch. He wanted his own lunch, one in a brown paper bag, just like the other kids. He wanted one, he said, because he knew a kid with a brown paper bag had someone who cared for him. This is what the left does not understand.
Now, first off, the story turns out to be apocryphal. It never happened. But aside from that, And just you got to tear this apart and think about the implications here. He wants to cancel free school lunch with the presumption that it's really just because his mom or dad doesn't care about him, as opposed to cost. Now, Paul Ryan would also have a problem with Jeff Madrick's proposal. Let's give that parents money. And he would have a problem with everybody gets free lunch in the school. Therefore, there is no stigma attached with getting that lunch. But the implication here is that if you are living in poverty and you do not have the money, your folks don't have the money to buy lunch for you, they don't care about you. This is all about the Republicans have been working on this for years. And maybe it's been just in decades. And maybe it's an American, the broader American thing. This notion that if you are poor, you are in some way morally deficient. And one of the reasons why when Donald Trump, we used to say this all the time, in the lead up to the Republican primary debates in 2016, I guess it was 2015, we used to say this all the time, that the Republicans have been arguing for years that if you don't have money, you are morally inferior. You're just inferior. The corollary to that is if you do have money, you are morally superior. And for months, we were saying Donald Trump is going to get on that stage and he's going to look around with these other people and he's just going to say, I'm a billionaire. So what I say is right and what you guys say is wrong because I'm a billionaire. And in fact, that was implicit in everything that went on in that primary race. And that is because the Republicans had built this hierarchy. Remember, they wanted a CEO president at one point too. They built it. They have built this hierarchy where if you are wealthy, you are morally righteous. And Paul Ryan was just putting it on display there. He was couching it as if like, you know, Democrats want parents not to care for their kids. The left wants parents not to care for the kids. They just want to, I mean, it's absurd. It's also not a true story. I mean, it's one thing to say like, yeah, I want my parents to care about me, but it's another to say like, yeah, I'm not going to eat if I don't want to eat. I don't need to eat. There is a lot of problems that predate Donald Trump and will be with us past Donald Trump.
You could economically empower those parents to have, you know, more time to and ability to make those sandwiches for those kids.
There's a myriad of ways of addressing that. And Paul Ryan's only one is we will help you out if you can find a job when you can't find one. We'll help you out if you can find a job even though you don't have daycare. It is, and we should also add, just to put a cherry on top of this, Paul Ryan ended up going to college because when his dad died, Social Security, this is the program that Paul Ryan was looking for years desperately to cut, Social Security stepped in. Part of that social insurance is for orphans and widows, widowers. And more or less paid for his college. And it seems, I don't know. I mean, I wonder if he feels like his parents didn't care for him or his mom didn't care for him because they didn't pay for his college. And the whole point of free lunches is because society cares about its children. I mean, that is exactly why you do that. So when that kid gets lunch, not only does his family care about him, but it's basically our collective way of saying we care about you. We think you have value as a human being. We think that you should get the bare minimum of what a human being needs. Maybe we need to raise the value of that bare minimum, and maybe as a society, we need to get there when it comes to things like housing and healthcare And in addition to nutrition, to the extent that we do that, and maybe even just like the ability to, like, I don't know, live a fairly secure existence without having to worry about these things. That's something to aspire for, to anyways. So, I don't know. Hope springs eternal with that kind of thing. We will, in the second hour, we're going to talk a little bit about one of the things that I've found amazing, and we should say again, we will be doing a live coverage tonight of the debate with Pence and Harris. I don't know. What do you, how do you guys think? We just got a minute and a half here before we sign off. We just a reminder, we are on the Choice channel on the Peacock app, and you can watch the show there. If you missed any part of this program, it replays at 5 p.m. and then replays through the night, as well as Mehdi Hassan's show and Zerlina Maxwell's show. And they're going to be adding more shows there. But we just, Matt, Brendan, give me your sense. We got a minute left. What's the debate going to be like? We should tell people also, Matt and Brendan are here. They're in a remote location. They just, their voices in my head.
I hope that Kamala treats it more like a prosecution than a debate. And if she does that, she'll be fine.
Brandon?
I think that is the only way that I will stay awake through this debate. And I'm very hopeful in that sense.
Yeah. I have a feeling I'm going to be drinking heavily if the last debate was any indication. But I have a feeling this one's going to be a lot more sort of traditional. But yeah, I would like, I hope... what I would like to see is Kamala Harris get up there and ask a couple of questions as to, like, hey, when did you guys in the White House know that the president was infected? I mean, I ask that only from a perspective of, you know, self-survival. It's very odd the way they handled that. But all right, we're going to sign off for those folks just joining us for the first hour, and then we will be back with our second one. And what do we got today? Well, Wednesday. All right. So Jamie's going to join us for the fun half today. And just a reminder, it's your support that keeps this program chugging along. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. I'm psyched about this this syndication deal that we have with the MSNBC, I guess, I don't know what they call it, sister channel, The Choice. I'm not sure. The is that what they call it? The Choice. The best thing about it is that we're basically on a platform with, we're sneaking in some stuff into the bloodstream, and we're doing it in a subtle way. And so that makes it very fun for me. It's also fun to have a clock again. I haven't had a clock in a long time, so I've got to hit certain posts so that they can cut. I guess they put commercials on there. But check it out on there. They have different graphics. They have a picture of me. We talked about this yesterday. That was a little bit awkward. But that's okay. I will take awkward photos. I'm not vain in that respect. Don't forget, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. And the AM Quickie, ladies and gentlemen, 7 minutes. amquickie.com, 7 minutes headlines news. Somebody sent me a very odd email based upon a note that their wife sent them about, thanks for the AM Quickie, Sam Seed, it was great this morning, that type of thing. It was weird. But be that as it may, check out Nomi's show today, youtube.com, the Nomi Key Show, and... can't believe it. And on her show today, Christopher Halali, a communist Antifa candidate running for Congress in Vermont. Jamie must be excited about that, right? Did you know about that candidate?
I did not. That's very interesting.
Also, the ProgressiveList.org founder, Nabila Islam, will be there. She ran for Congress, I think it was in Georgia. And Jordan Zakarian, creator of the Progressives Everywhere newsletter, 3 p.m. Eastern, noon Pacific. Check it out. Jamie, what's happening on the Antifada?
So this week on the Antifada, we have a two-part collaborative commentary track with our friend Swampside Chats. We watched an episode of Star Trek Deep Space Nine. It's a great one. It's called Past Tense. It's the one where three members of the crew go back in time to a San Francisco homeless camp at the time of a historic riot against neoliberalism that eventually spiraled into international revolution, bringing them the space communism that we know and love from the normal time period of Star Trek. So it was written in the 90s, and it really accurately predicts a bunch of economic crises of the current day, including Trump's rounding up of, or his plan to round up California's homeless population into camps, and, you know, maybe the coming lumpen revolution. So check it out, patreon.com/theantifada.
Matt, what happened on TMBS this week?
Last night we had Matt Karp on to talk about how we can learn from Abe Lincoln and the Radical Republicans how to scoff in the face of judicial supremacy and fight the Supreme Court. And we also talked to him about his Bernie 2020 retrospective. And then we also had Luke Mayville on to talk about Reclaim ID, the Expand Medicaid campaign that is going to have a documentary about, you know, how to go from door to door knocking and actually turn rural states blue is actually doable. And Luke showed how to do it in this with a at Reclaim ID is their movement. So that was all last night on at patreon.com/TMBS and the Michael Brooks Show on YouTube.
All right, folks, going to take a quick break, headed to the Fun Half, 646-257-3920. Be right back after this.
RM for it.
All right, folks, 646-257-3920. See you in the Fun Half.
Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back. Back, 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 back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back, back.
Just as delicious as you can imagine.
The alpha males are back, 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 back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back, 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 back.
Just want to degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back, back.
I take all of it in my throat.
Alpha males are back.
Almost says what?
The alpha males are back, 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 back.
You are a madman!
And the alpha males are back, back, back.
I am a total cunt.
Can we bring back DJ Dinner?
Yeah, or a couple of them. Just put them in rotation.
DJ Dinner.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough of a break.
That's fucking nonsense.
Hey, folks! Reminder!
I do not have Parkinson's.
And the alpha males are
psych.
Fuck them. Fuck them.
Almost says what?
What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What?
Almost says what?
Hell of a bank. Hell of a bank. Hell of a bank.
Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black Africans. And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black.
Out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keep it at 100. Can't not hustle.
Come on!
Fuck 'em,
fuck 'em, fuck 'em, fuck 'em, fuck 'em, fuck 'em.
Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday!
My birthday!
Happy birthday to me, Jew boy!
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black. Alpha males are back, back.
pussy, 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 puss